Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
This is our first event for the year, and I'm happy to say it was overbooked and unfortunately some people couldn't get in. And I hope all those names at the front there don't all turn up. However, thanks to Clayton Yutz for making it possible to enlarge the space that we've got, and also to our four panellists, who probably don't need any introduction, who are going to go through some of the many aspects of the WikiLeaks phenomenon, as it's become, and what would we have done this summer without it? Certainly if the emails got boring, Mr. Assange didn't. And I guess we'll hear more from the panel. They're going to go in alphabetical order according to their surnames. Richard Ackland, you'll remember, is Mr. Justinian, but also as a regular columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald. Janet Albrechtson is a columnist with The Australian and a well-known public commentator. Wendy Bacon is director of the Australian Centre for Independent Journalism and a professor of journalism at the UTS in Sydney. And Gerard Henderson is the executive director of the Sydney Institute and a weekly columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald. So without further ado, Richard, we'll hear from you.
Thank you very much. I'm just so impressed by the size of Clayton Yutz's boardroom. I just got confused and nervous. But thanks very much for the invitation to speak and discuss this topic with the other guests. I think it's probably a fair conjecture at this point to say that at the outset, Wendy Bacon and I may come at this topic from a slightly different point of view from Janet Albrechtson and Gerard Henderson. I may be wrong, but I think that our differences in the way we began in journalism may inform our perspective on this debate. So what has WikiLeaks done? And I'll commence with the obvious most recent releases of the State Department cables, which are the nub of the current controversy. WikiLeaks received a trove of about 250,000 documents from Bradley Manning, an army private with access to classified and computerised material. That's the allegation. This material was made available by WikiLeaks under some interesting and unusual agreements with five newspapers: Le Monde, El Pair, Der Spiegel, The Guardian, and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Guardian entered into a sharing agreement with the New York Times. The agreement was that each of the newspapers would select what cables it wanted, redact them, edit them, and publish them. WikiLeaks would then publish on its website the redacted versions of these stories published by its partner newspapers. WikiLeaks has not yet published anything, as far as I'm aware, from these cables that has not already been published by the six papers. So far, about 1% of the 250,000 cables have been published in edited form. The collaboration arrangements and agreements were spelled out last year in a very interesting article by Associated Press. I can give you an example of how this worked. There was in one of the cables from an American diplomat in Zimbabwe some information about Morgan Tsvangirai, who is, you know, in a joint government, but effectively the opposition leader in that country. And publicly, Tsvangirai had expressed his opposition to the sanctions against Zimbabwe. But the cables picked up that privately he opposed them. The leak of that information put Mr. Tsvangirai in a position where he could be charged by Mr. Mugabe's government with treason and maybe even death. So that was a very significant revelation. The media, mainly in America, picked up on this because there seems to be more of an anti-Assange, anti-WikiLeaks agenda in the United States for obvious reasons, picked up on this and said how vile WikiLeaks was. They've jeopardised the life of Morgan Tsvangirai. But that was not the case at all. WikiLeaks had not published that cable. They had given the raw cable to The Guardian. The Guardian was the only one that had published that information. And ultimately, The Guardian corrected the record. There was, a couple of weeks ago, a fascinating article about all of this in Vanity Fair, which some of you may have read, and it sheds new light on the relationship between Assange and his newspapers into which he'd entered into agreements. Basically, Assange wanted to control the rate of release of the newspaper reports. That was certainly the case with the Iraq war logs and the Afghan war logs. He said, in a sense, this information was commercially valuable to him. I think we all know that within WikiLeaks itself there's a lot of tension and not necessarily an entire amount of support for Julian Assange. As a result of that, someone in WikiLeaks leaked a vast bundle of cables outside the agreement that Julian Assange had with The Guardian and so on. And that leak to The Guardian took as exempting it from the agreement that it had with Assange originally. Assange threatened to sue The Guardian over this, which is a sort of interesting irony, you might think, that someone that had built his career on leaking would sue someone for publishing leaks. But Alan Rushbridge, the editor of The Guardian, managed to cool things down, and they've had a fairly fractured relationship ever since. Subsequently, I'm out of sequence there. Earlier, and I think this may have informed the way the Guardian responded to Assange, because earlier during the Iraq war log cables, which were a separate bundle that had come from, apparently from Bradley Manning, Julian Assange allegedly had double-crossed The Guardian. The Guardian and Le Monde, I think it was, there were two papers, had an agreement with Assange that they would publish the Iraq war logs. At the 11th hour, just before publication, Assange rang up the journalist that was coordinating this at The Guardian and said, "Oh no, I'm giving it to Channel 4. And all hell broke loose. That journalist has never spoken to Assange since. So they were dealing here with someone they thought was a double crosser, and that's why they went ahead with all the other cables that hadn't been subject to the earlier agreement. But look, the way you view these cables, I think, is very much just your own personal perspective in life. I don't think anyone's been killed as a result of them. Now, I read that one diplomat had to change jobs as a result of this. But maybe there are other consequences that we don't know about. But it just strikes me as being incredibly important, particularly in the context where we know we've been lied to by politicians about the Iraq war, about most wars probably. But it's incredibly important, I think, to know things such as, just a smattering of the things that I picked out that I found interesting, and others will have other interesting views. There were secret arrangements between the United States and British officials to subvert the plan to ban cluster bombs. It was not bad. A bit of information to have. The US government lobbied to restrict the terms of reference of the Chilcot inquiry. You know, that's the inquiry in Britain at the moment into the Iraq war and the truth or otherwise of the political underpinnings of the war. It was interesting to know that China is not all that enthralled with North Korea or Burma, and in principle has no objection to the unification of the Korean Peninsula. I thought that was incredibly interesting, particularly since it had always been hyped up that, you know, we're on the edge of another world war in the Koreas. It was interesting to know that the governor of the Bank of England had doubts about the economic credentials of David Cameron, to know that governments undermine international treaties, that there had been lobbying by the United States in Spain and Germany and Italy to go soft on CIA agents implicated in acts of torture. And, of course, there were the information about the Arab leaders lobbying the United States to bomb Iran. I mean, a lot of this is someone's opinion. It mightn't even necessarily be a fact. But it's an interesting other perspective that without all of this, we would not have known about. So I just think that's incredibly important. Plus, of course, that, you know, the response to this by governments has been and can be incredibly hypocritical. I mean, governments are leaking all the time to get their agenda up or some information to some favoured journalist. There was a book published by Bob Woodward last year called Obama's Wars. It was full of classified information. And yet no one raised a suggestion that Bob Woodward should be, you know, done over under the Espionage Act or some other law that might catch him. I just think that the justification for this has been cranked up considerably as a result of the lies that we know we were told to justify the Iraq war. There's now a much greater justification in journalism to get stuck into this stuff, classified or not. And in any event, my own view is that there's a vast overclassification of this material. A lot of it's gossip. I think someone wrote that it was amazing, the sort of gossipy nature of these cables. And it suggests that a large amount of diplomatic activity had been subverted by the fact that leaders can now pick up the telephone to each other and talk directly about the state of affairs and might sort of reduce the effectiveness and function of diplomacy as a result. But, you know, hard-bitten journalists always sort of trot out this line of Lord Northcliffe that journalism is about publishing stuff that someone doesn't want you to know, and all the rest is advertising. And I think it's true. All the rest is advertising in one form or another. And there were earlier things that Assange and WikiLeaks did. I better be quick. I mean, there's the wonderful... They published in 2009, I think it was, the list of sites that were to be filtered by the federal government under the internet filtering arrangements of Senator Conroy. They got hold of that list and published it. It was found that there were, you know, sort of dentists in Mossman whose websites were being filtered. Maybe there were sort of pictures of open mouths or something on these websites, and they... You can't have that. But look, I think the other element in all of this is that this technology, which enables secrets to be uploaded onto a website without any fingerprint, is not unique to WikiLeaks. I mean, I read the other day the New York Times was developing this bit of technology. I mean, why wouldn't any media organisation develop it? Why is it the exclusive preserve of WikiLeaks that only secrets that can be put up there without anyone's fingerprint on them is their exclusive preserve? I don't think it is. And I think you'll see newspapers rolling out systems whereby this can be affected. Just finally, I want to say this. I don't necessarily have a full brief for Julian Assange. I don't know anything about the sex case in Sweden. I don't think there's even charges there yet. He's wanted for questioning. There's no charges. But from what I've read about him and seen in interviews, I think he is a narcissist. And that's all right. There's plenty of people who are narcissists. But I think my own feeling is that WikiLeaks could probably do quite well even without him, even though he was the founder and it was his concept. Stuff I've read shows that he was much less careful about redactions or wanting redactions in the earlier Afghan war logs and Iraq war logs than the newspapers. And I think he has a sort of grandiose perception of his role in the world and his importance. But that's just my view. Thank you.
We'll hear from Janet Elkson now.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me tonight. Richard, you're right, we do differ on quite a number of things, so I'll try to get through them quickly in my time. During my recent summer holidays in rainy Queensland, I had intended to read John le Carré's new novel, Our Kind of Traitor, but instead I decided to read about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And it strikes me that there are more subplots, as Richard has touched on, in the story of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks than in any le Carré novel. Think about it. An Australian chap with a rather sad upbringing, homeschooled by his mother, believed that school would, after all, inculcate him, subservience to authority. He's a loner. He's convicted as a computer hacker in his youth. He's the author of a manifesto titled Conspiracy as Governance, and he sets up WikiLeaks in faraway Iceland. His co-workers, known only by a single initial, subscribe to Assange's worldview that the greatest battle is between institutions and the individual. A few years later, Mr. Assange seeks residency in Sweden to enjoy the cover of that country's rather generous laws for whistleblowers. And then he finds himself to be the subject of allegations of rape under Sweden's rather generous laws of sexual assault. The man who describes himself as the James Bond of journalism and brags about having no fixed address then goes into hiding and is hauled before a British court to face extradition back to Sweden for questioning. Then a group of leftists and misogynists join forces to claim that the poor Aussie chap is just a defender of free speech and is being improperly persecuted for political reasons. The prosecution for sexual assault should be stopped, they scream. The plot then thickens, as Richard touched on. Assange, who teamed up with the left liberal press to publish his leaks, cries foul when the Guardian newspaper publishes leaks from within his own organisation. Now, this is a racing plot full of lots of big characters. There's John Pilger, the intrepid journalist, Jeffrey Robertson, the long-winded lawyer, and Jemima Khan as the willowy blonde. And then there's a evil empire, otherwise known as the United States of America, hunting him down. Actually, I made that last bit up. But the Julian Assange story, which I think is best told by The New Yorker in a piece which was published last June, has done this very interesting profile. And if there's one theme that underlies the Assange story dating well back before WikiLeaks was established, it's that his life is one long drama of just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me. To date, the Obama administration has sent Mr. Assange one terse letter to cease and desist publication, and to no avail. As we know, the publication of hundreds of thousands of classified documents has continued much to the delight of supporters of Assange. Now, I'll only deal very quickly with three issues from this story. The first, very briefly, the sexual assault charges. Secondly, whether the right to free speech is enough to save Julian Assange, and whether Assange's objectives have been met by the WikiLeaks disclosures. As to the sexual assault charges against Assange, it seems It strikes me as ridiculous to claim that this is some kind of political prosecution of the man or persecution of Julian Assange. The two women who have made claims against him are surely entitled to have those claims proceed as normal. And that means that Mr. Assange is brought into questioning, and it means if the case then proceeds, it is heard before a court. But instead we find that these two women find their claims are being shot down in the opinion pages of the New Statesman as some sort of politically motivated conspiracy between the Swedes and the Americans. And I kid you not, there has been a suggestion that these two women are CIA spies. Like their hero, Assange's supporters see conspiracies everywhere. And while many are keen to paint Mr. Assange as the Anwar Ibrahim of Scandinavia, I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that's the case. Too many unthinking supporters of the WikiLeaks boss, a man they describe as the defender of the truth, seem terribly uninterested in searching for the truth about the alleged sexual assaults. They've reached their verdict free of evidence, and that's that. Well, I say let the sexual assault case proceed, but keep it very, very separate from any discussion about the virtues and vices of WikiLeaks. Now, if I had to sum up my attitude to the WikiLeaks stories in a few lines, it would go something like this, that governments all the world over keep far too many secrets, but that does not get Julian Assange off the hook. The release of documents by WikiLeaks has been an indiscriminate, potentially harmful exercise for no noble cause. It's not enhanced democracy, as his supporters would suggest. In fact, it's interesting that his most vocal supporters seem to ignore Mr. Assange's stated aims. It's the classic case of the useful idiots. They repackage the WikiLeaks phenomenon in romantic language about free speech and the truth, and yet ignore exactly what his objectives are, as stated by him. Jemima Khan helped post bail for Mr. Assange because she believes, quote, in the principle of the human right to freedom of information and our right to be told the truth. Well, I love freedom of information too, and free speech and the truth, and I didn't contribute any bail money to Mr. Assange. I've been defending free speech ever since I started writing. I've defended people I disagree with, including people like Philip Adams. You want to offend someone? I say go right ahead. Thumb your nose at the silly human rights commissions and all the associated laws that censor us from saying the most inane things. Hell, I've been a supporter of more free speech, not less free speech, often in battle with the liberal left. But it strikes me as curious that the left will often demand limits to free speech when speech allegedly intimidates, humiliates, or offends a group of people, and yet the same people will balk at limiting free speech when there are genuine concerns of national security for an entire nation. It's too simplistic to say that if you believe in free speech, then you must defend Julian Assange, because as we know, there are always limits to freedom of expression. Even the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights has its own set of limits. You may recall that it says that Congress may make no law abridging the freedom of speech. That means the agreed concept of freedom of speech subject to the limits that the law recognises. You may not shout fire in a crowded theatre. You may not libel someone. You may not incite one person to kill another. The WikiLeaks disclosures provide the perfect case, I think, of the nuances that are involved when we talk about freedom of speech. I, of course, believe in greater transparency and increased disclosure, but once again, there are sensible limits. The problem is that many of the WikiLeaks disclosures do put lives at risk, harm legitimate interests of nations, and undermine international cooperation on important issues ranging from Iran to terrorism. Mr. Assange told Time magazine that his aim is, quote, not to achieve a more transparent society, it's our goal to achieve a more just society. I'll run through just a few examples, but we can talk about some more later. WikiLeaks posted military documents that disclosed the confidential social security numbers of soldiers. Does that make for a more just society? WikiLeaks published the results of classified defence tests in 2004 that revealed how electromagnetic devices worked, and these are devices that are designed to prevent IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, used by insurgents. Now, this is information, obviously, that insurgents can use against soldiers. So does this make for a more just society? WikiLeaks released a mass of cables containing frank and brutal assessments by diplomats of one country in relation to officials in another country. And these were assessments made on the understanding that they were kept confidential. Does their release make for a more just society? Doesn't effective foreign policy depend on frank assessments being made? WikiLeaks has released US embassy cables which provide a how-to guide for embassy staff on how to handle a defector. Now, does it make for a more just society if a would-be terrorist learns how to scan the system by pretending to be a defector? The Taliban has announced that it's reviewing all the WikiLeaks documents to identify Afghans who worked with the Americans. Does that make the world more just? Now, these are questions that I think supporters of Mr. Assange often glide over with ease. There seems to be an unquestioning, almost fawning acceptance of his goodness. The hardest part of any rights debate, and that's what we are talking about tonight, is a conflict between rights. You can choose any right, including that most basic of right, the right to life, and you'll find that there are limits. And that balancing act of where we put those limits is what we're talking about. We can all draw rough outlines when it comes to free speech. As I said, we have limits about defamation and incitement to violence. Even Mr. Assange seems to recognise the need for limits on free speech when it suits him. He said that, like prosecuting Sarah Palin for inciting the shootings in Arizona, those calling for him to be executed as a traitor ought to be prosecuted. But even this curb on free speech is not yet settled. We're not talking about incitement tonight, but my point is that where we draw the line will always be subject to furious debate, and that is as it should be. Beware of those who spend very little time talking about where the lines fall, the Jemima Khans of this world. Now, once again, I think it's curious that the same people who can so quickly hang, draw and quarter the Bush administration for outing Valerie Plame have anointed Julian Assange as some kind of modern Robin Hood in cyberspace. This new saint, dubbed a truth teller by John Pilger, steals from the information rich and gives to the information poor. Well, if it was wrong to out Valerie Plame, and it was, how can it be right to out Afghans who have been working with the Americans, effectively delivering these people to the Taliban? Too much simplicity and just a dash of hypocrisy infects much of the crowd of supporters around Julian Assange. It's too simplistic to suggest that secrecy is inherently bad. Governments need to keep secrets. We may not like it, we may not trust it, but that is a reality. And certainly, as I said earlier, governments do keep too many secrets. When I was discussing this topic at home, even my 10-year-old son piped up and said, well, governments need to better classify real secrets. And this is a point that Richard touched on, and I agree. He's right. WikiLeaks has shown that governments need to classify information in more discriminating ways. And when they do classify information, they need to learn how to protect it better. It beggars belief that a low-ranking military man like Bradley Manning could have ready access to so much classified material. So secrecy is important. But I think, you know, when we talk about the leaks from WikiLeaks, we have to, they make for a fascinating read. Much of the stuff that Richard read out, it's certainly fascinating, and I agree with him, a lot of it's gossip. But we do have to distinguish between what is mere titillation for us and true revelation that would justify some of these disclosures. Supporters of WikiLeaks like to talk about the disclosures improving our democracy, and as I said, Julian Assange talks about making society more just, but WikiLeaks has in fact done neither. And this brings me to another oversimplification. I think it's too simplistic to refer to Julian Assange as a whistleblower. Whistleblowers are people who expose wrongdoing. Has WikiLeaks actually uncovered some huge conspiracy? Has it revealed a huge dishonesty or corruption? I don't think we're learning anything when we learn that Arab countries are keen for Iran to be dealt with brute force. So there's a bit of corruption in a high-ranking Saudi family. So Mrs. Mugabe has been squirreling money away in a Saudi bank. I don't think any of us are surprised by that. The question is, what is the cost of the WikiLeaks disclosures? And I think the cost will be that there will be greater secrecy among officials and governments, and that, I don't think, makes the world more just. So there's no nobility behind WikiLeaks. Others, of course, have written at length about the Pentagon Papers by contrast, and I'll only touch very briefly on this. But when, in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg released his papers to the New York Times, he did so with a very clear aim, and that was to make sure that the mistakes that were made during the Vietnam War were not repeated. But he understood, importantly, that some secrets needed to be kept. He withheld 4 volumes because he said, I quote, "I don't want to get in the way of diplomacy." Mr. Assange has no such scruples. In Papers on the War, Ellsberg wrote that within the US government, there were a whole set of what amounted to institutional anti-learning mechanisms, and that was his aim. He wanted the government to learn. Mr. Assange has no interest in helping any government. He's barely concealed anarchist views and more concerned with bringing governments down, especially the US government. In his 2006 essay titled State and Terrorist Conspiracies and Conspiracy as Governance, Assange makes it clear that his aim is to disrupt the ability of the US government, which he labels a conspiracy, to share information. He writes that with enough leaks and the threat of more, the security state will then try to shrink its computational network in response, thereby making itself dumber and slower and smaller. No, true whistleblowers preserve civil institutions by making them better. Mr. Assange has not done that. WikiLeaks is certainly not a simple matter of free speech, and I think Mr. Assange's motives are indeed very relevant. I might just end there, but we can certainly talk more about the Espionage Act, which I think is of some relevance. I mean, my preference, as I said at the outset, is that we may not agree where to draw the line, but it's something that needs to be discussed. And I would certainly favour laws that prevent the disclosure of WikiLeaks-style information where it harms Australia's national interest and imperils the safety of our soldiers and our people at home. Thank you.
I will hear from Wendy Bacon now. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk to you tonight, and I guess not surprisingly, I agree with almost nothing that Janet said. I'm also not the straw person that she's aiming at, and nor is Daniel Ellsberg one of Julian Assange's greatest supporters. Now, there's no doubt that WikiLeaks has some deadly, and I mean this literally, enemies. But let me acknowledge at the outset that WikiLeaks has excited and inspired many millions of supporters. These are the citizens who recognise that WikiLeaks' fundamental contribution is to reignite the relationship between the media and the people, which is supposed to underpin democracy. And as we journalists are so fond of saying, close to the heart of this relationship is the idea that journalists have confidential sources and they keep the anonymity of these sources secret on behalf of the public right to know. WikiLeaks supporters are everywhere, as probably is worrying Janet, I think. The ABC reports that up on Sunshine Beaches, where we all should be, they're wearing T-shirts in support of WikiLeaks. No torture, no terror, just truth, and on the back, where truth becomes treason, we're in big trouble. Or like the millions who laugh at the Robert Foster Cablegate rap videos, I don't know whether you've seen them, I strongly recommend them to you, and looking around this audience now, if you don't like them yourself, your children or grandchildren might. Now, WikiLeaks is and will be in the future far more than Cablegate, but I'll also mostly tonight comment on the massive leak of US diplomatic cables, of which only a fraction have been so far released. These are now already, we can debate it and discuss it, and I think this is a terrific idea. But these are now part of the fabric, of our daily fabric. They're a source of news stories around the world, but also they'll be a source for history. And as that rapper, Robert Foster, I just mentioned, says, history books will be written about these events. The history they tell is up to us. We've long whinged, I think you could call it, about the passivity of our mainstream media, of journalists being on a drip, of the frustrations of suppression orders, manipulation of freedom of information laws, intimidation of sources, the persecution of whistleblowers, and by the way, Julian Assange calls himself a journalist. Actually, he's not a whistleblower. And the government and corporate PR machines that make it a daily struggle if you're trying to do journalism to talk to sources who have answers to simple questions you might want to ask, which they would like to answer, but which you're blocked from answering them. And so cynical, I think, have we become about the media, that the idea that journalism could actually be about the truth or about serving citizens rather than powerful interests is often pushed aside as a cliche or even a naive illusion. So what exactly is the problem with WikiLeaks? The big problem with WikiLeaks is that they beat the game, in computer terms. They've beaten the game, and in that they've changed the rules. And while established media were still fumbling around and trying to find out how to use new media, Julian Assange and the rest of his younger team, who, as Richard said, don't seem to be getting on quite so well at the moment, but the rest of his younger team of media-minded people took their advanced technical skills and applied them to a new sort of news organisation, which will give sources the chance to safely leak information. Actually, Julian Assange has said, and whether this has always been completely done, that the idea was to scrutinise it, to minimise harm to individuals and to release it for citizens so we can make up our own minds. Now, this is nothing I'm saying is to suggest that I think, you know, WikiLeaks is going to revolutionise the media, to democratise it completely, or that they've never made a mistake, or that they don't have growing pains, or that they're not suffering from economic difficulties, which has certainly caused them to rely more on the mainstream media. But to the extent to which they have these weaknesses, they share them with the best and worst of our media organisations. And the effectiveness and the threat of WikiLeaks to complacent journalism is demonstrated by the fact that in the last few days it's reported that mainstream media organisations like the New York Times are now trying to sidestep WikiLeaks by developing their own improved boxes for sources to dump documents anonymously. And the WikiLeaks has been defended on hundreds of mirror sites that invisible supporters engage in cyber war to defend them when powerful companies try to starve them for funds, and that other organisations with slightly different methods and ideas are already planning to compete with them. And all of that is healthy. Now, some people have suggested, I think this argument's sort of gone by the way now, that there was nothing really sort of new in WikiLeaks and really we kind of knew it all. Well, that's really smug. It's also really elitist. And quite frankly, there's loads of stuff in there that I, for one, never imagined, and I doubt that many of you didn't either. Now, why I think this argument was particularly prevalent in Australia at one stage last, you know, December, I think that's partly because really, you know, maybe it's not that much at stake for a lot of people here in Australia that we are, as one cable says, the ironclad, not very powerful ally, sort of the client state. However, even seen from the Australian perspective, there is much very significant material. Like, for example, the US cables, which... Now, of course, US cables are only what the US cables say. They're not proof of anything, and I think it's important to say that. But the US cables that tell us that Rio Tinto, while people were freaking out and far more than they ever did have about Julian Assange, about whether he was getting all his citizens' rights, that Rio Tinto was, in fact, providing evidence to the Chinese government against their executive Stern Hu. And also, I didn't know that the Australian government had been asked by the US to get onto the Dutch while this was a big issue in Dutch society to keep them involved in Afghanistan. And the fact that we were taking a more aggressive line than the French and the Dutch, who apparently, you know, were too involved with reconstruction and not enough with war. All of that has come out of the WikiLeaks. Now, I'd like to quote just briefly, because I think, as Richard has said, you know, it is all up for debate. What the meaning of the information is, it does really, there's so much of it and it comes from so many different perspectives, like in terms of countries. But Brian Toohey, I think this is significant because it's about Minister for Foreign Affairs, Kevin Rudd, who of course poo-pooed the cables. I mean, yes, he's a control freak, he could sort of deal with that, but what he didn't deal with, and I quote from Brian Toohey's column in the Financial Review, sadly behind a firewall, Kevin Rudd's performance shows why he should not be the foreign minister. It shows that while he was the Prime Minister, he misled the public by claiming he opposed the deployment of US missile systems with the potential to undermine nuclear deterrence that has helped avoid a catastrophic war for more than 50 years. Toohey is also concerned that the Rudd gung-ho approach and the Julia Gillard's gung-ho approach on Afghanistan, sorry, Rudd's gung-ho approach on China and Gillard's gung-ho approach on Afghanistan could do long-term damage. Now, you may not agree with Brian Toohey, but that's the analysis that he has made, and that's what we need, you know, as an Australian community to engage with. Now, as one citizen who was really quite concerned with what was happening over there in Sri Lanka, who was appalled by the way our Australian media relied almost entirely during the conflict in Sri Lanka on Sri Lankan government sources, a government that had suppressed journalism viciously. And now we learn that the US cables said that not only did they think those massacres of Tamils were happening, but the current Sri Lankan Prime Minister was involved, and therefore they would be very unlikely to hold themselves accountable. Now, what I would like to know is, did the Australian government know about those cables, and why was nothing said? Why was it a blank wall to people who were trying to raise serious issues? It's interesting when you read the cables are from Tunisia. Because, of course, it's a country we don't really know much about, and then suddenly there's this long cable which fills us in very well and well-written and analysed. What's depressing about that cable is it ends with the conclusion that the best thing that the US can do, despite the fact they can see the human rights abuses and they can see the corruption, is to keep more silent, is to actually hide more. Now, how could that help anybody? And how did it ever help anyone that they were propping up a corrupt regime in order to promote their own special interests in the war in terror? All of these things deserve more attention. Janet has gone through some of the sort of things that are trotted out about in this sort of situation. When I say trotted out, I'm not saying that just in a mean way, because I was working at the National Times at the time when Brian Toohey released a lot of material. I think Richard was there too, and then he went on to do The Eye. I remember one particular story in a confidential cable he released, which sort of in a way is relevant to WikiLeaks, where it showed that the US Secretary of State had actually drafted Australian government press release about the shift in nuclear government, in nuclear ships coming to Australia policy. And all of the arguments, like it didn't take them 2 hours to get to the High Court to trot out all these arguments about harm and, you know, we won't have frank discussions and international relations are going to be damaged. Well, it depends on your perspective whether they're damaged or not. But the point is with these arguments is there's not an empirical investigation, because actually the US sources, the US government sources have actually said that nobody has been harmed. Nobody has been killed as a result of WikiLeaks. That's what they've said. But the point is, I don't know if there's a manual somewhere because it's not public. I wish it was. But there's no doubt some sort of guidelines for the arguments that you use in these situations. And so they've all been used again here. Now, I want to deal too briefly with the question of the sexual assault allegations, not because I think that they are the same as WikiLeaks, and I also am not saying that women don't have the right to make complaints, that sexual assault charges should not be dealt with. But it has, in fact, at the moment, those sexual assault allegations, it's meant that Julian Assange is under house arrest, and it's certainly seriously making it more difficult for WikiLeaks to operate. Now, what some people have said, anyone who criticises the Swedish government in relation to these sexual charges is somehow accusing the Swedish government of a conspiracy. That's not true. Nevertheless, I've got some things I would say about it. First of all, Julian Assange says he's innocent, and people who've spoken to him believe him. That may count for nothing, but Daniel Ellsberg's spoken to him. Michael Moore's spoken to him. John Pilger's spoken to him. You discount them all as, you know, lefties or something, but they've spoken to him. At least one prosecutor said that there was no case. And another said he could leave Sweden and did not take up the offer for him to be questioned before he left. That he is available for questioning right now. That he has never said he would not be questioned. And his lawyers are quite prepared to take him to the well-established facilities of Scotland Yard if the Swedish prosecutor will fly to London, as is regularly provided for within Europe. That someone passed a police file recently to The Guardian and led the well-respected journalist who's had been falling out with Julian, Nick Davies, to write an article. That missing was from that file were texts between the two women that were certainly relevant to any understanding of the case, and also other statements by the prosecutor. So the file was not a complete file. That Sweden, in fact, has a very poor record in pursuing rape allegations, and their record has been criticised by Amnesty and others. And in my own direct experience, I've been charged with one offence in order to get me into court on another. Now, that was one of the very first times I was arrested in my 20s. It was absolute par for the course. You know, I happened to be not guilty of that one. I was found guilty. It was all about getting me before the court. This is an absolutely regular practice in the criminal justice system. So to suggest that there could be a problem here, after you state all those facts, I think it would be wrong to remain silent. There's a record of prisoners being handed over in Sweden to the United States. How could any lawyer, in those circumstances, looking at what is happening to Bradley Manning now and the conditions in which he's kept, which amount to torture? Last week he was put on suicide watch. That's now been agreed to be a mistake, where he was allowed to have no clothes in his cell, no glasses, and he is being kept, as I said, in inhumane conditions. How could any lawyer recommend that Julian Assange rushes back to Sweden when it is highly possible, and no one seems to think he's really going to get charged with these sexual assault offences that I've spoken to, how could any lawyer advise him to return to Sweden? I mean, the interesting thing is that Julian Assange was rather pro-American and pro-Sweden before all of this. Actually, if anything, I thought he was rather naive about the United States, and certainly was much more critical of China. That was probably until the collateral damage video, which I hope you've all watched a few times, which shows the murder by US soldiers of innocent civilians, including journalists, which is justified as being within the rules of war, rules of engagement. I haven't. I'm winding up. Now, I haven't had any time to deal with the outrageous invasion of privacy by the United States inquiry, investigation into Julian Assange, which led to subpoenas being issued to Twitter and an Icelandic politician being in a situation. I'm sure we'd love it if it happened to our politicians, of all her credit records and everything else being served up that were part of Twitter. What's interesting is that Minister for Foreign Affairs in Iceland has no trouble in going to the assistance of his politician, unlike our own politicians who had no trouble in going worrying about what was happening to Stern Who, but somehow the first thing they could say about WikiLeaks was it was illegal and they were waiting for advice from the US government. I actually think that's disgraceful. Now, I'm not a naive supporter of Julian Assange. I'm not that interested in his character at this point. Actually, I'm more interested in WikiLeaks and the phenomenon that it is. The Australian Centre for Independent Journalism, of which I'm a director, has invited him to be a member of our centre as someone who has made a contribution to journalism, and I expect to get a yes from him very soon. Thank you very much. Jared Henderson.
Thanks. Look, I may cut some of my comments a bit shorter, but they'll be in the paper. Julian Assange may have had a troubled youth when growing up in numerous abodes in Queensland, New South Wales, and Victoria, but he was certainly fortunate to have been born some four decades ago, this for one obvious reason, and also due to the fact that Assange's emergence as an adult coincided with the age of narcissism, which afflicts contemporary Western society. And my colleague, my Sydney Morning Herald co-columnist, dealt with that, so I won't dwell on that point. But what's unusual and somewhat fascinating about this controversy concerning the right to know in Western democracies turns on the fact that here the argument is not between the left-inclined civil liberties lobby and such political conservatives as George W. Bush, Margaret Thatcher and John Howard. Rather, this is a dispute on the left of traditional politics, as John Pilger made clear in his cover story in the New Statesman on the 17th of January this year. In this article, the leftist journalist accused the left of centre President Barack Obama's administration of attempting to, quote, corrupt the law and send Assange to a hellhole prison for the rest of his life as part of a campaign of, quote, the imperial mafiosi to suppress truth. Now, this is familiar Pilgerism as hyperbole, but it is true that the political leaders who criticise WikiLeaks are left of centre social democratic types: President Obama, his Vice President Joe Biden, his Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the United States, along with Prime Minister Julia Gillard and her ministers Robert McClelland and Tanya Plibersek here in Australia. Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd has been inconsistent. He told Al Jazeera on the 30th of November that Australia was, quote, deadly serious about assisting any US efforts to persecute Julian Assange. But on the 12th of December, He appeared to change his position and essentially blamed the US's inadequate diplomatic communication system for the leaks. Now, in discussing the WikiLeaks phenomenon, it's important to distinguish between the ephemeral and the real. Considering the ephemeral first, it's important to state that the WikiLeaks controversy is not about... it's important to state what it's not about, in spite of the cult of personality and all that. Mr. Assange travelled to Sweden on his own volition and was subject to an allegation of improper behaviour by a young woman who was a member of the Brotherhood faction of the Swedish Social Democratic Party. This has been documented by Guy Rundle in Crikey and elsewhere. John Pilger senses a conspiracy in all this, but I don't. But then I'm not a conspiracy type. For example, I didn't see a conspiracy in the fact that when Saigon fell to the communists in April 1975, Mr. Pilger sought the assistance of Uncle Sam and did a bunk out of South Vietnam on a US military helicopter and ended up chumming up with the US, with the Saigon CIA station head on the Blue Ridge command ship. I don't see conspiracies like that. Sweden's laws with respect to the sexual offences are a matter for the Swedish and European judicial systems. Naomi Wolf never spoke out on this issue before allegations were made about Assange. It's up to the judicial systems to determine whether Assange is correct in his assertion that the case against him merely turns on a situation where one-time mutual lovers got, quote, into a tizzy, as he described the matter to the BBC. And contrary to the Assange-Pilger position, there is no evidence that the WikiLeaks founder is more likely to be extradited to the US if he was sent to Sweden rather than if he remains in Britain. That is not at all clear. These matters will sort themselves out. The cult of personality and the consequences of the fall aside, what are the real and lasting issues of the WikiLeaks matter? Now, first up, despite the intentions of Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks set, the US and Australia have emerged quite well from this document's dump. The leaks reveal that what diplomats from Western nations say in public is not dramatically different to what they say in private. Also, captivating gossip aside, and there's been much of that, there have been no big, unexpected and earth-shattering revelations in material released by WikiLeaks. That someone in Australia reading the Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald would not be, on a daily basis, would not be that surprised by what they've read in WikiLeaks. From an Australian perspective, I'm pleased that Kevin Rudd is concerned about China's military intentions and is disparaging about the role played by such nations as France and Germany and Afghanistan. And I've no idea why the opposition spokeswoman, Julie Bishop, would want to criticise the foreign minister for his views on these matters. But nevertheless, democratic governments, like media companies and journalists, are entitled to a degree of confidentiality, even secrecy, to enhance the effectiveness of their operations. An unintended consequence of the WikiLeaks phenomenon is likely to be increased secrecy as diplomats and politicians now suppress their private views, lest their inner thoughts are publicly revealed sometime later. And there is an unpleasant double standard here. Julian Assange is a secrecy freak who runs a secretive organisation. Yet when asked whether it was inconsistent for him to criticise the alleged leaking of details on the case against him by Swedish authorities, he replied, quote, "We are an organisation that does not promote leaking. We are an organisation that promotes justice." This is a ludicrous proposition coming from the founder of WikiLeaks. Now, the fact is that Julian Assange is a committed anarchist who is opposed to the current operation of Western democracies. This is made clear in the documents, which will be in my paper, some of which have been quoted by Dr. Albrechtsen today. And in response, Western governments are entitled to use the law to defend democratic governance from anarchist attack. Now, Mr. Assange may tell John Pilger that China is the technological enemy, but so far WikiLeaks' technological fire has been directed primarily at the US and its allies. And then there is the more serious case against WikiLeaks and its founder, as some of Julian Assange's one-time colleagues recognised, namely Mr. Assange has been indifferent to the plight of individuals who are affected, either directly or indirectly, by the dump, apparently initiated by the young US serviceman Bradley Manning. And it is noticeable that not many high-profile journalists or lawyers from the civil libertarian set or go-to lefty celebrities have lined up in support of Private Manning, who was facing the prospect of half a century in prison. Now, a few examples illustrate the point. Janet Albrechtson's given some of them, and I'll just provide one extra one. There's an article in the January 2011 issue of Commentary where Jonathan Foreman writes that Assange rejected a request from Amnesty International to consult it before releasing the names of Afghan informants on the Taliban who subsequently became targets of the Taliban. Finishing off briefly, I think the media is somewhat self-obsessed. That's not a great surprise. Initially, there was a lot of media action where many people in the media said the same thing in support of Assange or WikiLeaks or whatever. And I'm very pleased that at the Sydney Internet we've been able to present a wide diversion of views. But I'll conclude with a modest proposal, because if the civil liberties lobby is pushing for greater disclosure and the search for truth, I've got a couple of what I hope will be useful suggestions. Now, I'm referring to a couple of matters, which I think if we're all going to be open about matters, we can get a bit more information here. I'm referring to the decision of the Hawke government to pass legislation to prevent access to the papers concerning allegations against the late Justice Lionel Murphy for at least 30 years, and only then, at the whim of the President of the Senate or the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Some of those papers would be interesting to read. They've been suppressed in Australia for at least 30 years and maybe longer. And also the apparent decision of the Keating government to withhold the files concerning the espionage on behalf of the communist leadership in the Soviet Union by the pro-communist left in Australia in the 1930s, 40s and 1950s. Some of it's been covered in Mark Aron's very important recently released book. These documents were made available by a former KGB archivist who defected to Britain in 1992, and these documents, unlike in Britain and the United States, have never been released in Australia and still claim to be restricted. So if we're going to be open to all these matters, I think there are a couple of modest proposals where the civil liberty lobby might get to work and let's get a bit more information in Australia on matters that are not of concern to anyone who is alive, or virtually no one who is alive, but I think are historically interesting. But I've cut short my paper a bit, and I'll leave it here.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.